Okay, good afternoon everybody. My name is Bart van Wees, I'm from Groningen University, and I think most of you know me or have seen me before. It's a pleasure to be invited here in this very nice place. Yesterday Gerrit gave some of us the opportunity to also explore a little bit about, let's say, the wildlife outdoors. We barely survived, I think. We barely survived, but here I am. I have two talks today. I think they're focused around similar issues. And the first talk is a truly experimental talk, although I will show you that there is a strong link with theory. There is also a strong link with modeling. The second talk, I think at the moment, is still theory, although we're working hard about realizing structures, which I will discuss. So let's turn to the first topic. Well, let's first introduce these guys. You see this guy is happily spinning. Obviously this is guy is spin up, and this guy is looking not so happily, it's a spin down. So what is this about? I think this is about experiment we did very recently, which was let's say inspired by some predictions made by Gerrit Bauer and co-workers. And the main idea is the following. So this talk will be about metallic spintronics, and it's not because we see metallic as some kind of a holy grail, but for some kind, so let's say for some particular type of physics, it would be very useful to use metallic systems. Why? You can relatively easy make hybrid structures. If you put a metallic layer on top of another metallic layer, of course you have to worry about what is the nature of the interface. But you will already know, if you don't do anything special, you get the metallic contact. You can also put an oxide in between, so you can make tunnel junctions. So the way things proceed in metallic spintronics is that you really try to control, first of all, your layers. In our case, we will go a little bit further. We will make also devices where you can have different contacts. So all these things you can play with, which is, I think is relative flexible. But also, and then let me go to the next transparency. We are interested in physics, which happens in this case, which is related to the dynamics of a ferromagnet and the, let's say, the spin transport or the spin dynamics in a non-magnetic metal. And I think this is a very, very interesting research field. Why? Because first of all, there is already the important recognition, I mean, it has attracted quite a lot of attention, that if you send a spin polarized current into a ferromagnet, you can actually sometimes drive the magnetization motion, or you can actually damp it. So you can actually go to relatively small scale size systems, because all of this is scalable down to very small system size. Actually, it becomes more advantageous if you go to lower scales, because there the surface to volume ratio becomes bigger. So all these effects become more pronounced. So of course this would be one way, let's say from a technological point of view, had to make devices where you can switch magnetization not by having a magnetic field, which is rather cumbersome to do on small scales, but by using spin polarized current. My talk will be about a second effect, which you could almost call the inverse of that. So this is related to the spin battery effect, which is of course has been addressed by Gerrit Bauer and co-workers, but also by Berger. If we have a magnetization, a piece of ferromagnet, which is actually moving, or you could say makes a natural processing motion, it's going to emit a spin current. So this has already been observed as in the following way. Of course, if you have some dynamics, it will already be damped by what is called Gilbert damping. However, if you allow the spin current to flow out from your ferromagnet into the non-magnetic region, and it can relax here, it will introduce additional damping. So what would be nice now, if you could have a way where you could immediately transfer, let's say, the dynamics of your ferromagnet, let's say dmdt, into some kind of signal. Because in all devices, all practical devices, finally at the end of the road, your signal will be an electrical signal. And you see already how you could do this. I mean, this is let's say in a nutshell, let's say the prediction. If you have a ferromagnet which is aligned, let's say by a DC field, and if you have an AC field working, this is let's say the Z direction. If you have an AC field working in the X or Y direction, you can excite, let's say, the ferromagnetic resonance, and it's going to pump a spin current into your N region, and as a result, you get a spin accumulation here. How can you detect it? Well, first of all, you can put a second ferromagnet there. And it's well known that you can use that, and I will show that again in the next part of my talk. You can use it as a detector. But wouldn't it be nice if you could already measure a voltage directly between a single ferromagnet which is performing this precession and a normal region? So that is what this talk will be about. So, in the first talk, I will give you a little bit of an overview of the elementary concepts of spin injection. I think most of you have seen this already in some form, but I think it's always useful to be reminded of let's say the elementary description of spin transport. I would say in metallic systems. It could of course also be semiconductors, but there are of course more issues involved. In metallic systems, things, the basics are at least very, very elementary. So here I have, for instance, my a poor man's description of a ferromagnet. I have just two bands, and they are shifted by the exchange interaction. And what I now see, of course, at the Fermi energy, I have a different density of states. Well, of course, also there, the density of states will be different, but also other parameters like the mean free path. The mean free path for electrons with spin up and spin down will also be different. So both of them are relevant because they are both two important ingredients which determine the conductivities. So in our case, what is relevant for a ferromagnet, at least for the bulk description, is that the ferromagnet has spin-dependent conductivities. And this can be, let's say, the ratio of these conductivities can be of the order of, let's say, 50%. So if you have a metallic, like permalloy, it will not be 100%. This is a normal metal, paramagnetic metal, where we have no magnetic field applied. And of course, if we don't do anything, all the states, the spin-up and the spin-down states, are all occupied up to the Fermi energy. Well, maybe I should say that the temperature, of course, due to the temperature, it will of course be rounded. But that is not an essential ingredient in what is going to follow. So we can just assume that we have a very sharp Fermi edge, let's say. This is the situation where we have spin accumulation. So let's say maybe we have injected more spin down electrons, and as a result, of course, the occupation of the spin down states will increase. And clearly the difference between the electrochemical potential of the down states and the up states, you call spin accumulation. And you could also consider this as the driving force for spin transport. So, this is an experiment we did a couple of years ago. It is a geometry which was used first in a much bigger system but the idea is the same, by Johnson and Silsby. And what we did is here, what you see, that is a strip of aluminum. As a matter of fact, you see already, you can recognize that this is a few hundred nanometers, but you can see that you see a strip here and you see a strip there, and the reason is that it has been made by a special fabrication technique which is called shadow evaporation. And you do that because you can basically deposit all the layers, the aluminum and the cobalt, without breaking the vacuum. But what is relevant here is that we have aluminum, so this is our paramagnetic metal in which we want to inject the spins. We oxidize it, so it starts to form a thin oxide layer, and then we deposit two cobalt strips. And the main idea is, of course, very simple. We inject a current from the cobalt, let's say through the oxide layer, down into the aluminum, and we take it out there, and we are going to measure, we're going to attach a voltage meter or whatever. I mean, it's of course a little bit more advanced thing, but we're going to detect the voltage between there and there. You can already see that, of course, the crucial thing of this geometry is that there is no charge current here, because the charge can only go in here and can go out there. So if we detect the voltage here, and of course if we have, let's say, been careful enough to show to have more or less homogeneous injection of charge. But if we detect a voltage there, there can only be one reason for that, is and that there is a spin current flowing from the injector contact through the aluminum to the detector contact, which is then being detected. So this is the picture again. Here is my ferromagnet. I have a spin-dependent density of states. I'm going to inject the current. Well, and again, in a nutshell, it's of course not... The physics is far more complicated. You can say, well, what is going to happen is that the distribution of the injected spin-up electrons compared to the spin-down electrons is basically determined by the density of states of the ferromagnet. Again, the full story is far more complicated, but in first order, this is a way to understand that you inject spins with a finite polarization. So what's going to happen there, these spins you are going to create in the aluminum underneath the cobalt, you're going to create spin accumulation. And this can basically do two things. It can either relax with a typical spin relaxation time, which is of the order of 100 picoseconds, or it can diffuse. It can of course diffuse this way, or it can diffuse in that way. And if it diffuses in this way, in such a way that there is still some spin accumulation left there, this contact, is actually doing the reverse of the injector contact. If I offer a certain spin accumulation, and the spin accumulation will of course be directed in the direction of the magnetization, and the magnetization of these guys is due to the long shape, it's either up or it's either down. So let's say I have net spin up electrons in my aluminum, and let's assume that the density of states for the spin up electrons in this cobalt detector electrodes is the largest for the spin up electrons. So that means that you will have more electrons tunneling into your ferromagnet. So this ferromagnet will preferentially measure the spin up electrons. This contact is a reference contact. It's fixed to the aluminum, but it's fixed at a position where there is no spin accumulation left. So the idea is now the following. This is not attached to anything. Yeah? So the idea is the following, that this guy, depending on whether its magnetization is up or down, has a preference for either spin-up or spin-down electrons. So if you, let's say, offer more spin-up electrons, they have the tendency to go in. They prefer to go into the cobalt relative to go, well, compared to continuing straight on. So, but however, this is a voltage contact. So you have electrons going in. So a voltage has to build up to have a similar charge current going out. That is the way how this works. Okay, again, this is what I've shown, but now it's a cross section. This is a typical expression for the polarization of the injection. This is more or less the same. I inject the spin accumulation here and look how it proceeds. If you do, I think this is now quite relevant. If you solve the equations, which are, let's say, basically the Bloch type equations for transport, now this is, I think, a relevant picture, which is a little bit strange if you see this for the first time. So what I plot now is the black lines would be the potential. This is what I would measure if I would have a non-spin selective probe. Obviously, the current is going in, it's going out there. So that means that here I will have, let's say, what you call Ohm's law. I will have a constant, this is the electrochemical potential, it will change linearly with position. So that would mean, of course, I have a constant electric field. Here, there is no charge current, so there is no, the average electrochemical potential for spin up and spin down is just zero. Of course, now I have, let's say, injected more spin up electrons. What is going to be the fate of those electrons? Well, I have injected more spin-up electrons, I have injected less spin-down electrons, so the electrochemical potential of the spin-up will be higher than this baseline, and the electrochemical potential of the spin-down will be lower. And you see now, if I go towards the detector, and if I do this on a scale smaller than the spin relaxation length, if I am here, if I would have an ideal detector, which would have a spin polarization of 100%, and it would, let's say, its magnetization would be aligned with this with this spin direction, it would measure this potential. If you would flip it, it would measure that one. And the reference electrode will be here. So you see that this voltage of this contact relative to this one can be positive in case of these, when the magnetization corresponds to the direction of the injected spins, or can be negative when it's the opposite. So, okay, let's go. So, now the idea of the experiment, of course, is clear. Again, we have our, now it's a top view, and we send the current through here and we measure there. But you see that the sizes of these electrodes are different. And the reason is, of course, that first we are going to apply a magnetic field in the plane which is big enough to align both of them, let's say, in the up z direction. Then we're going to reverse the field slowly. And then this guy, which has the lowest coercive field, so the coercive field is determined by many factors, but you can control it on this scale by controlling the width. That means, of course, the magnetization has to go, and it has to go via some intermediate state. And it turns out that if the ratio between the length and the width is large, the coercive field will be bigger. So this guy will switch first. So you go from parallel arrangement to anti-parallel, and if you go further, then also this guy will switch, you go back to parallel. And of course, to be sure that you're measuring spin transport, the signal which you measure here should be opposite to the signal which you measure here, but this signal which you measure here should be the same as you measure there, because if you change the polarization of the injector and the detector both, you will still get the same result. So this is what's seen here. I have to go a bit fast here because this is basically intended as an introduction. So the idea is here, we now both are aligned parallel, I get a positive voltage. But beware of the signal, huh? We're talking about milliohms. Why is that? Because the resistance of our metal is of the order of, let's say, ohms. But as we will find out, the polarization is of the order of 10%. So we polarize the electrons only by 10%, but at the same time, the detection efficiency is only 10%. So in total, we only measure signals which correspond to about 1% of the typical electrical resistance of this piece of aluminum. So that would be of the order of milliohms. So what we do is here, of course, we start with the positive signal, which we expect, and then here we go negative. We see that the signal almost completely reverses, and we go back, when the second electrode also switches, we go back to this line again. So this is proof. There's no other way how this can be understood, that in terms of spins being injected here and being able to diffuse there. This is at 4.2 Kelvin, at room temperature it still works. This is an important message here. All of this stuff also works at room temperature. It's a little bit smaller, the effects, but there is no fundamental difference between doing this at low temperature or at room temperature. You also see that there's a little bit change in the coercive fields. But that's
this work far, you didn't have an upside?
Yes, but let me come back to that later. So what you do is obviously, and I can go fast through that because this is well known, you do the experiment, you repeat it for different spacings between your electrodes, and then you measure delta R, and you see that the signal, if you make a fit, this is a logarithmic scale, and if you can basically fit it with a linear behavior on a logarithmic scale, which then tells you that the signal decays exponentially when you increase the length. And of course the typical length scale on which the signal drops, that should be the spin relaxation length in your normal region, in your aluminum. So, do I have any, I have some numbers there. What is relevant, I mean, this sets basically the scale. Let's look at this one. This is the room temperature data. It's about of the order of a few hundred nanometers. So this is important to realize. This is basically fixed by the, even if you would take fully clean aluminum, then the electron phonon scattering actually limits this value up to, well, at the value of about a micrometer. So this is the maximum you can achieve if you would use ordinary metals. So now I come to The next step, and I think this is relevant for the second part of my talk, not so clear if it's a theory, but here we have a top view again. Here we have the magnetization pointing upwards, here also pointing upwards. So this, if you inject current here, it would inject spins on average, which have electrons which have spin up. But now I also apply a magnetic field perpendicular. So if this would be a nice one-dimensional system, what would you expect? Well, the spin enters here, it would move in this direction, and in the meantime it would precess. And it would precess with a typical alarm or frequency. So what you could do in principle here is tune your magnetic field in such a way that the electron which is injected with a spin up, well, precesses and then arrives as a spin down electron there. So in a one-dimensional case, if you would plot your signal as a function of B, you would have, and these, the magnetizations would be parallel, you have a positive signal when there's no magnetic field, because you inject spin-ups and they are detected and they produce, let's say, positive voltage there. But if you tune your field that you have 180 degrees precession, you get a negative signal, positive, negative, etc. Of course it does not work, because we are dealing with a diffusive system, and this is now very important. So what you should do now is you should now basically use this equation, which is again Bloch equation. So it actually describes the time derivative of the mu, and mu is now not a scalar anymore, it's a vector. It describes the spin accumulation in three directions. You see that it has a regular form of a diffusion equation. This is the spin diffusion coefficient. It has a term which is essentially the precession, because this describes the this is proportional to the B, and it describes the Larmor precession, and this guy describes the relaxation. And now what you see is the following. So what you see in an experiment, what we have done is we have done this experiment. We have basically aligned these two electrodes so that they're parallel, and we applied then a perpendicular magnetic field. So what you see now is a functional field. You see you start with a positive signal, then you go down, but you don't reach the opposite value. Why? Because it's a diffusive process. So if you apply a certain magnetic field, well, some electrons of course can make it relatively fast, so they have precessed only a small angle. Some electrons scatter around, they take a longer time to go from there to there, so their precession angle will be different. So there are two things going on. You will have an average precession, and of course here the average precession angle will be 180 degrees, because you go negative, and then but in the meantime you're also averaging out. And I will have to write this now on the blackboard. So we have two length scales. There is the spin relaxation length, which is the square root of the diffusion constant times the spin relaxation time, and it's the square root because this is due to a diffusive process. But there is another one which we call L omega, and that is the square root of the diffusion constant over omega. And omega is a typical frequency in the problem. This would be now the Larmor precession frequency. So what does that L omega mean? That is typically the length scale. Suppose you at some point you inject electrons pointing, let's say, in this case the negative x direction. You have a B field on. Well, they start to enter. Altogether, they start with the same angle, but then again, some electrons will go straight ahead. Some electrons take a little bit more time. So if you have entered this material over this length scale L omega, you can actually say that you have electrons which have, some of have processed maybe 90 degrees, some of them 180 degrees, etc. And this is typically the length scale over which these precession angles average out. So this turns out to be a very important length scale. It is of the order, if you apply one Tesla, it is of the order of a few hundred nanometers. So these length scales actually compete. And you can actually fit this by using this formula, and you can get both the spin relaxation length again, and you can again get this length scale because you can extract the diffusion coefficient, and you also know omega.
Can you replace the aluminium by some other
We have done done several experiments, but let's say also copper, but that doesn't change the picture too much. It just has a different spin relaxation length. So this is not a. I think this is not a.
Mu is supposed to be the smaller, having a smaller spin.
No, of course the general. The general trend would be if you take lighter materials, they have less spin orbit interaction. This is the spin relaxation is due to spin orbit interaction, which can be either generated by scattering from imperfections or impurities, or by electron phonon scattering. So the general rule would be, if you take lighter materials, the spin-orbit interaction should be weaker. But aluminum is a little bit of a weird material, because it has a little more complicated Fermi surface. And don't ask me about the theory behind it, people call this hot spots, and apparently they are responsible for most of the spin relaxation. If you would do the same thing in magnesium, for instance, I'm not sure if this has ever been tried, you would almost certainly find a much longer spin relaxation time. And sodium, certainly even longer, but I don't know how to do the experiment with sodium.
Aluminium has p electrons.
So let's skip this one. So this was a little bit of an introduction, so at least showing you that there is a lot of, I would even call this mesoscopic physics. In mesoscopic physics you work with length scales and different length scales, which of course include the material properties. But you can actually say you put in the material properties, then you have a model which is based on length scales and on time scales, and then finally you have to solve it to get your hopefully to get the solution of your problem. So, after this introduction, let's go to what we have done here with the with this problem. So, this is a bit a complicated graph. So let me now try and explain. If you want to read it, I can refer it to a paper of Su Hui Wang and Gerrit Bauer. The idea is to follow, but I'd like to summarize this in a few minutes. So the idea is the following. I have a piece of ferromagnet which is aligned by a magnetic field. So, and now I'm going to excite this with a, and I will show you how this is done, with a magnetic field. This is the Z direction, this is the X and the Y direction, with a magnetic field which is, let's say, in the Y direction. And I'm going to tune the frequency of your magnetic field in such a way that I excite the ferromagnetic resonance. So that means that in the ideal case the precession angle will be constant and the magnetization will make some kind of precessional motion. So now I'm not going to summarize all the details of the spin pumping theory, but the prediction is now that this ferromagnet, in the absence of all other driving forces, and we just start first with this precession, it is going to inject a spin current into the normal metal, and I'm using a one-dimensional model, so the spins can only flow in one direction. But if I talk about the direction of the spin current, I mean of course the direction of the spins which are being injected into the normal region, and the direction is given by M cross the MDT. So we have, let's say, M pointing this way, we have M making a precession motion and going into the board like this, so the MDT is like this, so M cross the MDT goes like this, and the prefactor that is given by a parameter which is called the mixing conductance. Thank you, Gerrit. I will have to speed up. I'm not going into the details of this mixing conductance. I will only show you this. I need my hands, right? So what is this mixing conductance now? So here is M. So I'm interested in the problem finding out what is my spin accumulation close to this interface. Yeah? So I have to consider several currents. Well, this is the first current which I have. I have to say something about the mixing conductance. This is M. Suppose now I have close to my interface a spin accumulation which is either parallel or anti-parallel to the ferromagnet. Then I know what I have to do. Because I know for the spin-up electrons, they can enter the ferromagnet. They could also, the interface could have a spin-dependent conductance, but that have to take into account. They can diffuse into the ferromagnet. They see the spin-dependent conductivity of the ferromagnet, but after some time, they will relax due to the spin-flip relaxation. Yeah. So, if you look at the spin current, the idea is the following. I have spin-up electrons entering, then somewhere in the ferromagnet they flip their direction and they come out like this. Yeah? So this is what happens to the longitudinal component. If I have the perpendicular component, the things are much worse. Yeah, because you have to describe, okay, I have a spin, this is M, this is now my spin direction. If it wants to enter the ferromagnet, then of course you know that you can decompose the spin, let's say, in the x direction as a component being in the z direction and in the minus z direction. But because of the exchange interaction, these components will have a different time evolution. So in reality it means, let's say in a classical description, is that this electron comes in and it will start to process very rapidly. Now, what can happen is the following, that this spin current is fully absorbed. Or you started with a spin accumulation like this, so there is a spin current in this direction entering, and it's totally messed up. Yeah? So that means effectively that this so-called spin mixing actually absorbs, is a typical conductance which tells you how fast the component of the spin accumulation perpendicular to the interface relaxes. There is another component I have to say, because imagine that this is my magnetization, here comes my spin, it enters a little bit, it processes and then it comes back. Then you see it has a different angle. Yeah? So there is a second contribution, which I will forget this for the moment. I will just assume here that this, and this is relevant according to the theory also by Paul Carey, that this turns out to be for normal ferromagnetic interfaces the most important component. So you can understand what happens if an electron wants to enter the ferromagnet. Yeah, that you could actually say the component perpendicular to the interface is messed up very rapidly, and that can be described by typical conductance. Turns out that if you drive the ferromagnet, the ferromagnet will also emit a component, which is this one. And I don't have I'm also not trying to give a full physical picture for that, but these two processes are relevant, are related. So okay, now we have this, to speed up a bit. So I have this component going from there to there. You see that there is also a DC component. Yeah? Because if you project it along the Z direction, you see there is, no matter where you are, you will have the component along the Z direction is constant, and the component along the X and the Y direction oscillates. So this is what is coming in. Now, the question is, what happens here? This is a complicated story, because look at this. As a result of this spin current, you will have a spin accumulation here, which you will have a DC component along the Z direction, but also AC components in the X and the Y direction. And you have to keep track of all of them. Yeah? So what you have to keep track of course, some of these spins can also diffuse into the normal metal. And two things can happen there. They can relax on a typical length scale, which is the spin relaxation length, or they can be also, I would call it, mixed in the normal region. So this you have to include. However, that's not what I do, and also that is not what Xuhui Wang and Gerrit Bauer do. They just say, I assume that here that there is the averaging which occurs of the XY component so strong that I can just assume that I have a constant spin accumulation in my N region, which is pointing along the Z direction. That's an assumption. It's sometimes valid, sometimes not. But that's so. But now we only have the incoming spin current. To get finally the value of this mu s, we have to also calculate what is now the spin current which flows back into the ferromagnet as a result of this mu s. That's again also a complicated story, because as I told you, there will be a contribution of the mixing conductance, and also for the component which is perpendicular to M, but also you have to keep track of the component which is longitudinal to M. Yeah? Again, this is all nicely described in this paper. For our experiments, it's sufficient to know that the precession angle for us is very small. It's a few, only a few degrees. So we know exactly what is happening here. We only have to consider M will be very small. So if we decompose a spin accumulation which is pointing in the Z direction in a component along M and a component perpendicular to M, well, if we forget about the component perpendicular to M, and we assume that we can basically treat the flow of let's say spins back into the ferromagnet in very much the same way as I described in terms of the spin-dependent conductivity of the ferromagnet. It's a long story, but so let me now show you the experiment. So what we do have to do is the following. We have to make a ferromagnetic strip. This is a typical, the details are not important, but what you see is the following. We have to make a small ferromagnetic region where we can control the precession. That's one. And so, and that's what we do here. Typically size is micrometer. We have to make a relatively large AC magnetic field. Why? We want to get the precession angle as big as possible. We would actually prefer, let's say, that this would be the Z direction, this would be M, to have maybe not a precession like this, but maybe have even the full precession where the precession angle is 90 degrees. So how do? We cannot do this in a cavity, because we will have to generate magnetic fields of the order of 10 millitesla. This cannot be done in a cavity because you need a lot of power. So what we do is we make what we call a coplanar waveguide. You can actually see, well, this is, has three, you have three strips, but that's not so important. The idea is that we can send out, we connect this, this is a strip, this is, of course, this is nothing, again a strip, this is nothing. So if we make a waveguide like this, the idea is that we can keep the characteristic impedance the same. So we can start with relatively big sizes of, let's say, millimeter, and we can connect it to a source of radio frequency current. Then we can zoom in, let's say zoom in into a smaller region here. And actually what we do is we short circuit the waveguide. That's what we do. Okay? So we send in a certain power, RF power, typically 10 gigahertz or something like that. And we send it down, it will travel, I mean, according to the laws of a waveguide, but here is short circuited. So we get a relatively large AC current here. So that's the idea. Well, this is how it looks in reality. Here again, you see, this is typical size, 10 micrometer. Here we see the ends of the waveguide. You see very big, because we want to send big currents through. And here there is this poor wire where we want to send the big current through. And if we zoom on this one, what do we see? This is typically a micrometer. So we're sending a big current through here. This is going to generate, the current is going like this, so we get magnetic field lines, of course, going like this. So there will be a relatively big magnetic field, AC magnetic field, pointing like this. And what we're now going to do is, of course, we're also going to apply a DC magnetic field, constant field, in this direction, to align the magnetization. So we're going to make a precession motion like this. How do we probe this? Well, we have to make contacts to it. We have to make two contacts to it, otherwise we cannot measure anything. So we have two geometries, one where we make contacts at the end of our strip, and we also have a geometry where we make one contact in the middle and one at the end. And the reason for that I will also explain. So, again, but now from a different side, we have again this view of this waveguide. And there is this current flowing there, it's making these magnetic field lines. Here is the strip, this is your static magnetic field, and this is the two voltage contacts. So what we do now is, I mean, we know that there can be a lot of what we call parasitic effects. Certainly if you work at high frequency with ferromagnets, you can have a lot of effects which actually, or you could even say mimic, spin transport, can induce all kind of voltages. So what we do now is we take on purpose a material like platinum, which is heavy, which has a very short spin relaxation length. So the idea is that all these poor the spin current from the ferromagnet is immediately killed by the platinum, by the spin relaxation in the platinum. So there is no current going back into your ferromagnet. So this contact should not produce a voltage. This guy is aluminum, and we know the properties of the aluminum. We know that spins can travel for a couple of hundred nanometers before losing their spin direction.
So
I don't know the no, it's probably more. It's of the order of maybe, I don't know, 40, so tens of nanometers, I would say.
spreads out between 1 nanometer till 40 nanometer.
Yeah, we have never measured this, but it's definitely much. It's not angstroms or something like that. This guy, of course, we know. So the idea is, if we do this experiment, yeah, and we go through the ferromagnetic resonance, and I will show you how we do it. Then this context is supposed to generate a voltage, and this one is not supposed to generate a voltage. However, we don't know what's happening in the bulk. So what we do is we make two other samples, one where we have only aluminum contacts. So here in this case, both should develop a voltage. But you see, if you go through the circuit, then these voltages will cancel. Yeah, because suppose aluminum is positive compared to permalloy, then this guy will have exactly the same opposite sign. So also here we should not measure anything. And this is platinum, and certainly here we should not measure anything, because all the individual interfaces should not give us a voltage. Okay, so what we do, I mean, this is technical detail, but it is important. What we use is, we are going to scan the magnetic field, yeah, and we are going to do that not with a fixed frequency. If we fix the frequency of a scanned magnetic field, at some point we will satisfy the condition for ferromagnetic resonance. Now, what we are doing is, because we want to measure small voltages, so we actually want to use some kind of lock-in technique. So we're going to modulate the frequency, in this case with a central frequency of which we are going to scan, and we are going to modulate between with a change in frequency of 5 gigahertz. In this way you can understand that any background voltages will average out. If you have an amplifier, it also produces a certain DC voltage, and if you now measure the difference between the response at 20 gigahertz and 15 gigahertz, well, DC voltage from the ferromagnet does not change, so that cancels out, and we can only look at the voltages from our ferromagnet. This is typical data. This is magnetic field which is scanned. I mean, let's focus on a single trace here. This should be voltage, of course. This is the measured voltage, and we scan the magnetic field. What we see is two peaks. Well, in this case, this was done with a measurement where we had a central frequency 17.5 gigahertz, and we measured the difference between, let's say, 20 and 15 gigahertz. So what you get is two peaks. I mean, one, let's say, a peak which corresponds to 15 and a dip which corresponds to 20. I mean, it's just a consequence of the measurement technique. But you clearly see that, and that's the important message, that we get a nice peak. Yeah? And this is, and at the other frequency we also get a peak. It's a little bit, this one you see already is not a nice, well, it's definitely not a nice Lorentzian. So there is a little bit more going on than is within our simple description. Well, let's go back.
Is that the voltage from one of the contacts?
It is the voltage measured. This is for the aluminum platinum sample. Yeah, that's important. I will show you the full data. Okay? So this is the... I will show you the full data, but let's first focus on how sure are we that this is indeed a ferromagnetic resonance, because we have to be careful. Because we are not sure that we are measuring the uniform mode. Now, if we have a uniform mode, that is the lowest frequency, we have just the ferromagnetic strip doing like this. But we can also excite spin wave modes. Yeah? If we have a spin wave mode, again, well, let's do it like this. This is the uniform mode. If we have a spin wave mode, the first one would go like this. Yeah? So, I'm not sure if it's clear. Of course, both the up, the top and the bottom is processing it with this in the same direction, but basically 180 degrees out of phase. So that's important why we have to check what we have. And so what we can do is we can measure the position of these peaks as a function of frequency, and then you see you get a certain dispersion relation, and we can compare it now. I mean, with the standard theory, Kittel theory for ferromagnetic resonance, this is the uniform mode. I give the expression here, but I think it's not so important. And we can indeed see that we can fit the position of these peaks with the theory for ferromagnetic resonance, but for a uniform mode. So, this is the full data. This is platinum aluminum. So what is important to see is that we get nice peaks and nice dips. You see Again, there is a bit more going on than just a single, certainly at low magnetic fields. It's not a nice symmetric peak, but we get peaks of the order of 215 nanovolts. We have repeated this with at least six samples, and we get a certain spread in this signal. But it's all within, let's say, 200 nanovolts and 300 nanovolts. This one gives you this guy, the blue one. That's the result of the aluminum sample. Yeah? And now you see it also gives a peak. Yeah? But sometimes we see in one sample it gives a peak, in the next one it gives a dip. So what does that mean? We have two interfaces. One, the aluminum permalloy here, but they are not quite the same. There you can already see from the SEM pictures that, well, if you zoom in, they're a little bit different. So our hypothesis is the following, is that the magnitude of this signal is very sensitive to the shape of the normal metal which you put on top. And this is perfectly in agreement with the fact that the spin dynamics in this normal region will have a major effect. What you see for the platinum, this is the black signal, you see indeed there is still also a small signal left here and here, but it's much smaller. Yeah? Again, this is perfectly in agreement that the platinum permalloy interface is much less effective in generating a voltage. So if you have two interfaces, again, because they may not be completely the same, you still are left with a signal, but in any case it's much smaller than for the case of the aluminum. If they would be perfectly identical, there would be nothing. But no, you don't have any theory. Huh? No, but the point is what, of course, we try to do, and you can see it. We try to keep make the contact the same. But you can already see from the SEM picture that it's just because of the alignment which you have to do. You first make the ferromagnetic strip, and then the next step you have to put. There will be a little bit of a shift. So what we conclude is that apparently this voltage is very sensitive to that. It could also be that maybe the aluminum is a little bit thicker than the other one, I mean 10% or something like this. We cannot avoid that at the moment. So the claim is that the aluminum permalloy interface gives a voltage. And if you have two of these interfaces, you measure the difference. But because of the variation, the difference can sometimes be positive, but in another experiment negative. Certainly the permalloy platinum interface gives a much smaller signal, which is exactly in agreement with the whole thing.
Is it tone counting between all them, or?
Sorry?
Is it tone counting between all those metals?
It's a good question. It's a very good question. No, it's not a tunnel contact. It is a metallic contact. Direct contact. We have not oxidized the surface. We have actually explicitly removed any oxide which would be there.
Can you measure how the strength of the signal depends on the AC field?
Yes, that's this one. This is this one. In view of the time, this is not linear response. Yeah, because you generate out of an AC driving signal, you generate a DC signal. So the first order effect would be that your signal, your DC voltage, will be quadratic in the strength of the applied field. And this is the voltage applied, but it's the voltage applied to the generator. So effectively, this is also the effective magnetic field. So you see that the magnitude of this DC voltage scales quadratically. And what does that tell us? Well, of course, for small precession angles, that is what's supposed to happen. Yeah? But if you have big, of course, then if you drive it with big magnetic fields, okay, you cannot have precession angles bigger than 19 degrees. So we're certainly still in this regime where the precession angle is of the order of a few degrees. Well, we can actually check it. Okay, let me go back here. So what we did is for the following. Maybe I should add this one. Let's conclude. So how do we know the precession angle? And now we have an effect which is called anisotropic magnetoresistance, which could lead to some spurious effects. This is the simple effect that if I have a piece of ferromagnet which I align with a magnetic field, I send a current through and I measure the resistance. Now I do the same thing, but I have now a magnetic field perpendicular to my current path. Then I see that I get a change in the resistance of the order of a few percent. So this is illustrated by this curve. This is the magnetic field. This corresponds to this situation. I start out with a high magnetic field, a high resistance, because in the absence of a field like this, the magnetization will be aligned more or less along the easy axis. Then apply a field, so the magnetization is going to rotate, and I see that there is a drop in the resistance, and finally, of course, the magnetization points in this direction, and the resistance does not change anymore. So this is very nice, because we can use this, and I'd like to conclude there, to get information about this precession angle. Yeah? So if we know what is the maximum anisotropic magnetoresistance, so what is the maximum change between parallel and perpendicular magnetization, well, we can just measure the change in the resistance which occurs, and from that we can extract the precession angle. This is what we did here. Well, I'm not going into detail, but what you see is the black one. Again, we change the magnetic field at a certain frequency. We go through the ferromagnetic resonance. You see the black one. This is the let's say, the spin pumping voltage. But here, at for all the other curves, we have sent on purpose also a DC current. And you see that here in this case, you get for positive current a positive signal. In negative current, you get a negative signal. This is the AMR. So from that we can extract a precession angle, which is at most a few degrees. Also, and I would like to conclude with that, is the following. The AMR, how that scales, is very simple, because the theory tells you that the change in the resistance goes like with the cosine of the angle between the current and the magnetization. So if you increase, if you go through the ferromagnetic resonance, well, you start out with this one, it's going to precess like this, and then it goes back to zero. Yeah? So for small angles, cosine can be approximated by angle squared. So actually what this guy, this curve basically tells us, what is now the precession angle squared if you go through the resonance. Yeah? However, if you look at the spin pumping signal, it looks different. Yeah? If you would scale this guy, you would not get this one. It's much narrower. You can also look at this one. Here I have applied the current in such a way that the sum of my spin pumping signal plus my AMR signal should be zero, but it's not zero. Yeah, so the conclusion is that this DC voltage generated by the backflow of the spins does not follow nicely the precession angle squared. So there's more going on. Okay. This is all done at room temperature. I will conclude now. I've shown you these samples which we can put in the middle. Well, there is much more going on. This is a bit more complicated. I will graph. But imagine now, this is a grayscale. So the black corresponds to the dip, and the white corresponds to the peaks. Well, you can see it better here. Let's look at the positive half. There's not only one peak, there's a second peak. So how can it be? Yes, so, and we see this only in this guy. Let me go back.
How can it be?
Well, we already have some explanation. Because, and this one has the same context here. Should not produce a voltage. Well, only, of course, if the precession of the ferromagnet would be uniform. But now let's look at the first spin wave mode. And then this guy is processing like this. This guy is processing like this. Well, but 180 degrees differently. And in the center, there's no precession. So the point is then, if we excite this spin wave mode, where there is no precession in the center, but there is precession at the ends, a voltage would develop even if you have the same context. And I think that is what we're seeing here. It's the power. We have applied more power here. We have also tried it with this one. Yeah, where we have two contacts at the end. There is a little bit of this also going on, but the strongest effect occurs at high power if we have a geometry like that. So somehow we are also exciting at higher power for reasons we do not fully understand, not only the uniform mode, but also the first spin wave mode. And that is a bit that's a bit difficult to understand, because look at this. This is just symmetric. Huh?
If you could excite whatever you want, you would also be able to double the voltage in the first setup.
No, because the voltage is proportional, let's say, to the precession angle or to the precession angle squared. It has no information, for instance, about the phase. Yeah? So you say, if you have indeed in the first excited spin wave mode, you have But there the precession amplitude here is the same. It's only 180 degrees out of phase, but that's not, you cannot measure that. Okay, well, I will stop now. So what have we observed? We have observed the generation of a DC voltage due to spin current being injected into the normal region and flowing back into the ferromagnet. Again, this is what I emphasize, it is completely non-trivial, because what is very relevant is the spin dynamics in N. So we have made a simple assumption that the spin accumulation in N is a constant. It will not be a constant. So in a real experiment. So what we also have observed is a value which is smaller than the prediction of theory. It's about...
That still has to be figured
out. We have to figure that out, but we have to have a little bit of a discussion there. So I think the theory gives the first order, as it stands now, a first order indication of the magnitude of the effect. But if you really want to understand the shape, we have to include the fully model the spin dynamics in N, which is a very interesting challenge. At higher powers, we have signatures of the spin waves. All of this is being submitted to PRL. What is next? What is next? So what we now have is a tool, so by which we have just a single ferromagnet, we can translate its precession information into a voltage. So that's very nice, because you can measure it. You cannot measure the magnetization, well, you can in principle, but it's because more and more complicated to measure magnetization dynamics of very small pieces. Here you can just measure the voltage. So, and we also see that we have a tool also, in principle, to make this voltage bigger. So we have to play around with the geometry of N. Of course, the mixing conductors is an important one, but you would not expect, if you have a contact between a ferromagnet and N and a normal region, that the geometry of the contact makes a difference. Here it makes a difference because of the control of the spin dynamics. We want to go to precession angles of 90 degrees. It's possible. We have to increase the power we apply. And there is, I think, another very interesting subject here is, can we see now the interaction with the DC current? So if you apply a DC current through the system, can we see that we can maybe change the precession angle? So can we see that we can drive it, or we can also damp it? And all of this is on our program. Thank you.
So you were saying about the spin waves and so on. The picture, I guess, where the boundary condition is that the derivative of the magnetization is zero at the end.
Yes.
So I can ask this to you, and others may also know. So my understanding is that that's not necessarily exactly the boundary condition. What is known about that?
I am not an expert. We have, of course, tried to look up the theory, but. There are several things. One of them is, if you would have a piece of material, what is of course relevant, what drives the spin wave mode is the exchange interaction. Yeah? So in addition to the torque of your applied magnetic field, you also have a torque, because there is a difference in magnetization between the parts. So the question is, if you also have a demagnetization field, which we definitely have, I mean, we do not have an infinite strip, or we also do not have a nice ellipsoid. That means that also the demagnetization field is not a constant, and means that certainly at the ends, you will get already in the static situation, you will already get a different alignment of the magnetization. So that could be one ingredient which could mess up the simple picture. The other one is the dipolar interaction. So I'm not sure how this works out, but I think if you make the system bigger or at least thicker, then you also get dipole-dipole interaction, which is just the interaction of the magnetic field generated by this piece of ferromagnet on the other part of the ferromagnet, and that can also change the picture. So the answer is basically, we do not know exactly what would be the... We have put in some numbers, including the value of the, let's say, the exchange, well, it's called D, the interaction strength. And then we found pretty good agreement, given the fact that we have a length, and given certain length, and given the...
Taking into account
that indeed we put as a boundary condition that the magnetization as function of the precision at the ends is constant. Yeah? So I'm not sure this okay. So we have no doubts about that what we're observing is true, the signature of the spin waves, but concerning the dispersion relation, we have to think about it. Yes, yes, I'm sure. But I am not so sure if so many things are being. I am not so sure if you could help me for this particular type of geometries, which are basically a thin strip geometry. It's difficult to find any reference. Okay, I would like to know the references later. Yeah, but no matter probably what you.
You should know. Well, I kind of know that people work a lot.
Well, that's.
I mean, I probably know one reference which.
No, but I mean, no matter what kind of interactions you take into account, I mean, you would also, of course, have this have an alternating sequence of symmetric and asymmetric or anti-symmetric spin wave modes. That's also. Okay.
So that when you actually say spin wave modes, do you mean like exchange driven or those more magnetostatic modes? So, and magnetostatic, I guess, those are the ones where essentially include the effects of magnetic field generated by spin, but not necessarily. So essentially, just macroscopic Maxwell waves in a sense.
No, the point is the ones I'm referring to is that let's say you have. Let's say one part of the set, the bottom one would point like this, and the top one points like this. Yeah? So that means there is an extra torque, yeah? Say working from there, this one on this one, and the opposite way. And why is that? Because of course there is this the exchange interaction. And what I'm saying is that if you do that, and you have a thin film, and you make the film thicker, yeah. Then of course the magnetic field generated by this part will become bigger, and also the area. So that scales in a different way than when you only have exchange interaction. And I'm not sure exactly what is in what regime we are, if we should already worry about what you call the magnetostatic. But I'm sure that
when you have short wavelengths, that's when you need to worry about exchange, because in those lambda ellipses, Gilbert, you get the second derivative.
I'm not so sure, but what I expect that certainly the thickness will play a role there. But we have to think about this. Yeah.
I mean, the point where you explain how from the main wall thickening are.
You missed the point where.
Explain how you exclude the reason the main wall thickening.
Good question. Of course, we have no image, visual image of our magnetization profile. We can only use basically our own. How can we then tell that there is no domain? For instance, by also measurements of the anisotropic magnetoresistance. As I've shown you, what we do is we align the magnetization with a big field like this, and then we scan the field. Oh, sorry, yeah? And then that's what we do first. Then we apply a magnetic field like this, which we make increase in strength. So of course then there is a competition between the magnetic field which wants to line the magnetization like this and let's say the shape and isotropy. And if everything goes according to the theory for just having this is Stoner-Wolfhard, I think, and then you can actually calculate what would be the shape of your magnetization direction as a function of the angle. And you put it in the AMR theory. And that's about what I showed you. So I think we're pretty sure that, and we are also not doing wild things to our ferromagnet. We are not switching it. We keep it the same. When we go through the resonance, well, we already have a certain field applied, so we already know that's pretty much aligned. And then we apply our AC field. And I also have to say that at low fields, which I have not shown in detail, there are more things going on which could be associated with maybe some domain walls or whatever. But at least what I've shown you is very like, I mean, almost certainly single domain behavior.
Question?
Yeah.
So the platinum differs from aluminum because there's been diffusion lens is much smaller. What do you have to compare the spin diffusion lens with the other lens?
Again, that is a good question. So
let me see if we will take.
Let's see.
Let's look in words.
So somehow it shows that in the spin dynamics or the spin dynamics, the spin relaxation in the normal region plays a role. Yeah. And so the question is, if you do some you could put this in terms of spin dependent resistances. So there is of course a source of current, spin current from the ferromagnet into my in the region close to the interface. Yeah. We know that this spin current can also flow back, but also can go into the normal region. So when do you have to take into account the effect of the normal region? Well, let's say when the typical resistance of that path going into the is comparable to the resistance of the other paths. So if it would be you inject a spin current here due to the spin pumping close to the interface, if this fastest path to go into the ferromagnet, the spin current will do that. So I think it means that the normal region will really start to affect this behavior when, let's say, the typical relaxation lengths are of the order of the relaxation lengths in the ferromagnet, which is 5 nanometers or something. Yeah, so probably, so I think that is, you're talking about that kind of length scales. So if you would change your spin relaxation length in the normal region between 1 micrometer or 10 micrometer, I think it would hardly make a difference. Yeah, because the electrons, they have to travel a long path and they have to go back, which is typically a big resistance. But again, this needs a little bit more of looking into. It's fine. If you give me, if I can give a glass of water, I will just continue. Werkt ook, want dat hebben we ook gedaan natuurlijk met dat is helemaal 1. Maar daar kun je geen contacten erbovenop maken, want dan dat kan wel, maar daar moesten we dus een geometrie maken met eerst een ferromagneet en een kruisgeometrie van koper of zo, en dan twee ferromagneten hier en dan stroom zo sturen en zo de spanning meten. Ja, en dan kan je kan dat, ja, dat kan wel, maar als je dus hier een normaal metaal maakt, je doet er twee ferromagneten op. Ja, en je wil weer dat experiment doen, dan gaat natuurlijk de meeste stroom die loopt van daar naar daar al. Je wilt dan kan je dus niet. Maar bovendien heb je daar dus nog dat probleem van de conductivity mismatch. Dus dat de tweede ferromagnet zal dus een behoorlijk gedeelte van de spin-accumulatie opeten. Ja? Het wordt hier gegenereerd, zeg maar, en die spin-accumulatie differentieert die richting op. Maar als hier nou nog een ferromagneet is, dan is dat een behoorlijk effectieve drain. Nou, je weet dat de elektronen die in de ferromagneet gaan, die komen niet meer terug. De kans dat die terugkomen zonder een spin is. Ja, dus je krijgt sowieso al een verzwakking van jouw effect. Dus dat is het voordeel van die. Maar hier heb je daar niet zo last van, want je kan hier ook een tunnelbarrière nemen. Dat werkt ook wel. Maar dus je verandert dus de mixing conductors. Die worden dus een stuk lager. Dan kun je zeggen, nou, teruggaat wordt ook een stuk lager. Maar dan wordt weer de rol van jouw. Ja, dus je
kunt.
Mag ik heel even eerst mijn dingen. Waar is mijn dingen? Waar is mijn huis? Ach nee. Ik moet het opnieuw doen. Godsamme. Mijn muis zegt nou goed. Het is weer aan de wandel. Ik heb geen idee wat dit nou weer is.
So how long is the break going to be?
Ask Gerrit, I think 5 minutes
and understood. As long as anybody's outside, there will be a break.
Can you also ask Gerrit to bring me a glass of water?
Do you have
the ski wall or something like
that? One for... Yeah, I can...
I will give a second talk in 5 minutes. Can you ask? I'm sorry, I have to start this up again because my mouse had a problem. Can you ask Gerrit if he can bring me something to drink? Water of iets van cola, als je dat ook nog hebt. Nou ja, het maakt niet uit. Ik neem liever even water, maar mijn muis heeft weer een probleem, dus ik moest het er even opnieuw doen. Ik begrijp ook niet waarom die...
Gewoon morgen met water dan?
Ja, gewoon water. Nou ja, je had koffie... Was het bedoeld voor mij dat of niet? Nou, geef mij gewoon maar wat koffie met melk en suiker.
Koffie, melk en suiker?
Ja. Heb ik niet bij me nu. Sam, kut muis. Is dit nou wat onzin?
Ja, het is in de Piabie. Ja, ik doe een experiment.
Ik heb geen idee. Dank je.
Maar ik just cracked the data.
Nou, ik probeer het nog een keer, maar ik weet niet wat het is, maar anders moet ik het even hier...
Kan ik maar een ander muisje halen? Misschien dit voor mij? Misschien...
Ik weet niet wat het is, anders kan als ik haal ik hem, of dit aan de muis ligt of het aan de... maar blijf eventjes in de buurt, want anders dan krijg je een probleem. Oh jongens, nou kom op. Ik ben mijn muis helemaal kwijt. Hier, dit begrijp ik dus niet. Of dat aan mijn muis, als ik hem er nou uithaal.
Oh, dat ziet er niet zo goed uit.
Het ziet er niet goed uit als ik hem er nou uithaal. het wel proberen. Maar,
humor is toch, ja, dus dat
ja,
kan
maar dan moet hij dat wel doen. Dat doet nooit wat. Ja.
Dat kan ik me nog herinneren dat ik dat vroeger wel vaak had, die desktop recovery. Ja.
Kijk nou. En als die doet, dat is
nee,
niet.
Nee, die heb je niet
door. Oh, die eruit gehad. Nou, laat me gewoon even zo doen. Santa Barbara 2, dat is die. Ik heb een leesbril nodig. Dat is mijn contactlens. Ja. Twee keer of één keer? Twee keer toch?
Twee keer, ja. Nee, dat was niet twee keer. Doet hij nog steeds niet.
Oh. Nou.
Ja, oké, dus.
Ik heb verder die hele muis niet nodig.
Ik heb het verder niet nodig. Je moet gewoon...
Ik heb het wel eens eerder gehad, maar een tijd geleden, maar we zijn er nooit achter gekomen wat dit nou was.
Kun je dat hier even met free zetten?
Ik kan dan een keer met 10 gewoon doen. Ik kan met 10.
Ja, precies.
Ja, het blijft moeilijk om dit uit te leggen, dat vorige, maar goed, dat is hier. Moet je, ja, je kan er, je moet er ja, gewoon nee, puur ervaring mee opdoen, nee, hoor.
Mensen moeten het ook gewoon een beetje goed opdoen, inderdaad.
Nou kijk, hoe is dit nou mogelijk? En ik heb dit, en nou ga ik dit doen. 5. En nou... Dat, ja, ja. Wel, dat is het wel. Klopt, diezelfde, dat het niet zijn, ja, blijft
niet, nee, niet helemaal, want hij heeft nu zijn kop te groot niet.
Jawel, maar daarnet deed hij dat anders als ik nou. Jawel, maar dit is niet zo'n ramp hoor. Wat verdomme. Kan ik nog wat hiermee wat mee doen?
Ik, ja, doe dat nog eens een keertje uit en aan, ja.
Dus ik kan dit eens proberen, dat hij dat automatisch.
Even uit. Juist. En nu aan, dan doet hij misschien
wel. En doet hij nou wat?
Binnenhalen. Ben je klaar?
Ja hoor, want die drinken wel zijn mijn koffietijd is de ding op. Goeie koffie, Gerrit. Ah ja.
Ik word er niet wakker van,
should pay me by hour to give a talk here, eh? Not per talk. Okay, let me, I think almost everybody is here, is back, that's what I said, pal. Let me start with the second talk. I realize, of course, when I looked at it, this title, what would you do if you would enter a room and so somebody would give a title with a talk like this? You would probably run away. But I will hopefully show you that it's worthwhile to listen to this talk. What is the basic idea behind this talk? This already started some year, well, 1.5 years ago. And it's actually also very closely related to this interaction between ferromagnets and non-magnets. So to both effects, there is the spin current, which is produced by a precessing ferromagnet, and the other one is the, and that will be the first part of the talk, and the second one is the driving of the magnetization precession of a ferromagnet due to the spin torque. So what we were asking ourselves the question, of course, what in all these theories, what is now the special thing about the ferromagnet? Yeah? Well, what is now the special thing? Of course, there is exchange interaction. So this exchange interaction is extremely strong. So, as I told you, all the relevant physics for the component of the spin, which is perpendicular to M, that happens always very close to the interface, because the typical precession length is only a few nanometers. However, what would happen now if you would not take a ferromagnet? If you would not take a ferromagnet, but you would just take a paramagnetic metal, like again aluminum or something like that, but now you apply a magnetic field. Yeah? So this magnetic field could also, of course, play the same role as this exchange interaction. So the question we have asked ourselves is the following. Suppose we have a paramagnetic medium, metal, aluminum, copper, whatever, and you apply a magnetic field, which actually does the same thing as your magnetization would do. And suppose I would apply a magnetic field which has a constant component in the Z direction and has a, let's say, oscillating component in the X and the Y direction. So let's say the magnetic field would do something like this. Or perhaps you could even say, let's assume a magnetic field which just rotates in the X and the Y plane. Would it then also generate pump spins into a region where there is no magnetic field? So this is, well, let's say, I will, and the answer is yes. And I will tell a little bit about it. I think time will be too short to address all the details, but at least I can give you a flavor. Now, the second thing is the following. So, if we have a ferromagnet, we can use the fact that it's rigid, it has a magnetization. So, this magnetization, if it processes it, it will emit spin currents, but it can also interact with currents. It can be driven also by spin currents. That is because this magnetization is very rigid. The magnitude is more or less constant, and it can also only change the angle. But now if I take a certain region of a paramagnetic metal, I could also imagine that at some point I have a spin accumulation, which could be so big that it actually starts to generate a magnetic field, which can also interact with the environment. And in this way, we have been able to predict that if you have a certain geometry, which is a relatively straightforward geometry, and you inject a spin current into this geometry, and this geometry is basically nothing else than just a paramagnetic metal, that at some point it could actually start to oscillate by itself. That means that it will start to behave like a maser. This is very strange, and we were of course not also surprised to find this, but I think this is the outcome of a very logical and I think straightforward route, which I would like to describe. So I will tell a little bit about our model for this paramagnetic spin pumping. I will say a little bit about what happens, and this was I think the main theme of this paper. What happens if you have a region where you apply this, let's say, processing magnetic field, and if you couple that to a region where there is no magnetic field, so it looks very much the same, like a ferromagnet coupled to a paramagnetic metal, then we can actually show that by adding this such an interface, you can greatly enhance the spin accumulation. I will also say a little bit of whether it would be possible to see this in experiment, and then as the final part, I will say something about our proposed spin injection driven maser. Okay, this I've discussed. So let me start with our idea. So our idea is the following. We were asking ourselves the question, suppose now I have this paramagnetic region, how should I describe this, and how should I describe this in the presence of a magnetic field which is changing as a function of time. So Let's start to do this. I have I just consider spins in one direction, let's say the Z direction. I have spin up and I have spin down. This is my Fermi energy. This is just the density of states. Of course, I use a simple parabolic band, but it's not relevant. It turns out that the only relevant quantity is the density of states at the Fermi energy. So you can have a more complicated band structure. The only thing which counts eventually is the density of states at the Fermi energy. So let's now suddenly switch a magnetic field on. What's going to happen? I do this. So what I'm going to do, of course, I am going to lift the energy of the spin-up electrons relative to the energy of the spin-down electrons. And of course, the amount by which I do this is just the Zeeman interaction. It's the G-factor times the Bohr magneton times B. And the G-factor in the materials which we consider simple materials is two. It's almost equal to the, let's say, free electron value. So what you see now, that after sudden switching on of your magnetic field, what we get, a situation like this. There is no magnetization, because the number of spin-up states is still, compared to the number of spin-down states, is still the same. However, we see that we have now created a situation of spin accumulation. Then we have, in a certain energy range, we have only spin-up electrons and we have no spin-down electrons. So what is going to happen? If we have switched the field on and then we keep it constant at this value, we know that there will be spin relaxation, because these electrons will actually scatter. The spin-up electrons will scatter into spin-down states, and eventually we get a situation where the Fermi energies or the electrochemical potentials of the spin-up and spin-down electrons are aligned. This situation now, of course, has a magnetization, but it has no longer a spin accumulation. So you see there's a little bit of a funny interplay between magnetization, which is, let's say, of course, the property which is relevant if you want to study the interaction with a magnetic field, and the other quantity is the spin accumulation, and that is of course the quantity which is relevant if you want to study spin currents and also interaction with external spin currents. So, well, what can you do? This is of course rather straightforward. What you do is the following. Now assume, let's go back here. Now let's assume now that we do not suddenly switch on the field, but we have a certain dBdt. We have a certain rate of change of the magnetic field B. Well, we would get more or less the same picture. So if there would be no spin relaxation, these are the spin-up states and these are the spin-down states. If there is no spin relaxation and we apply AC magnetic field, then we see that these guys will just go like this. We will just get an oscillating spin accumulation. If there is spin relaxation, it's almost the same as let's say in electrotechnical engineering, like an RC circuit. If there is no spin relaxation, the spin accumulation will just follow the Zeeman interaction. If there is spin relaxation, of course, this motion will be damped. Finally, we will always remain very close to this situation, and of course, there will also be a 90 degrees phase shift. So what is important now, and this is what we do, so we are saying is that we can represent a time-dependent magnetic field working on, let's say, the bulk of our paramagnetic system in terms of a spin source term. And this is, I think, very important. Let's go back. So, as a matter of fact, we do not care if, let's say, this excess or the spin accumulation is produced by the fact that we lift the spin up compared to the spin down by this time-dependent magnetic field. We do not make a difference between that situation or a situation where we would implicitly or explicitly inject spin-polarized electrons at the Fermi energy. Yeah? Of course, from a fundamental point of view, it's not quite the same. So this is a time-dependent problem. I have a time-dependent magnetic field. I have to solve time-dependent. If you want to do quantum mechanically, the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and the other case is just injecting a spin-polarized current. But within our framework, we consider this as equivalent. Yeah. So now we know how to introduce a time-dependent magnetic field. We introduce this as a source term, which is like this one. It's like G mu B times the time derivative of the magnetic field. So now we proceed. Of course, now we want to make things a little bit more interesting. So now we have the xy plane. We put B in the xy plane. Well, in our convention, the resulting spin accumulation points then in the negative direction. Of course, the generated. I have to be careful what I'm saying. This is of course the non-equilibrium part. Yeah, that is the thing we are interested in, the spin accumulation. So what we're now going to do is we're going to look what happens if we make the magnetic field rotate in the xy plane. So I've shown it here. Well, here I started. Here is the magnetic field is, let's say, rotating in some steady state situation, and I want to know now what is mu. Well, there will also there will be some inertia in the system. So mu will not point exactly again along the axis of the magnetic field. It will lag a little bit behind. Yeah. And you could say, well, so what? This is just an ordinary relaxation process. But you see already, it lags behind. So now it has a component, which is basically, let's say, the projection of this guy on this one. It has a component which is perpendicular to B. Well, this component, of course, there is B, there is a component perpendicular to B. This two components has a tendency to process around B.
Is the smooth the same as manipulation?
No. Mu is this one. Okay, let's... This is mu. Yeah? So it's the thing which you would measure electrically. If you make a contact to it, this is the thing which will generate a voltage. Yeah? So if you make it, yeah? So this
is this different from the xenon thing, G mu b.
What is different?
The net mu difference is the same as net delta z, right?
No, this will be different in general. If you would switch it on suddenly the field, then you see, of course, there will be no change in the spin direction. So then immediately after switching on this field, the delta mu will be equal to the Zeeman energy. If you wait long enough, it will go down exponential. And now I'm considering the fact this is just in one dimension. I'm considering what happens in the if you would rotate.
If it's equal to zero, they're the same thing, then they'll be different.
Yes.
And by spin accumulation, you mean the box spin density, basically, right? That's what you mean by spin accumulation?
No. Wait a minute. I think this is important. Let me go back now. This is important to get clear, because there is what I mean with spin accumulation. So if I do a transport measurement, if I connect it somewhere to a region which has some spins, what matters? The system does not care about this one. It only cares about what is happening at the Fermi energy, right? This is the driving force for spin transport is not the spin density. Because look at this one, the spin up and spin down densities are the same if you calculate by unit volume. No, it's what's happening at the Fermi energy. It's the difference in electrochemical potential between spin up and spin down.
Well, let's say this. So you're using mu, which is a vector on the next page, I guess.
Yeah.
To characterize the electron distribution function.
That's correct.
Right?
So I should say, of course, this is in one. Yeah?
Yeah, the density matrix, I should say.
You could also. You could also call it the density matrix, but let's say, let's stick to the simplified picture, and I mean everybody would agree with me, I hope. If you look at spin transport, or what is relevant is this quantity, which is called spin accumulation. This is in one dimension. You would call this the mu z, the spin accumulation in the z direction. If you have three directions, you make it into a vector. No, you don't know. You don't know in what direction it is. You know, of course, that the magnetization in equilibrium, you know that the magnetization direction will be aligned with the field. But you don't know what is the non-equilibrium part. That depends on the dynamics of the system.
Well, this particular case where you just turn on the magnetic field in the same direction, obviously it's the same direction.
Yeah, this should be then.
So,
yeah.
So then what you're saying is that when you now start rotating, then it lags behind because of the velocity.
Let me proceed. I think that this it's important to realize that magnetization and spin accumulations are different quantities.
Let me just say as a digression, I don't think this terminology, even if it is absolutely standard, but spin accumulation for this thing is very good. Is it absolutely standard? I mean, I understand.
No, let's say I'm not certain about everything what I'm saying, but I'm here, I'm certain. Yeah?
Well, you can define things as you like. I have no objection to that.
No, I'm sorry. The point is, what is the difference now between this guy and this guy, right? So, how?
There's a difference.
No, there is a difference.
What is the mathematical definition?
No. The vector mu is the thing which consists of the three components of the spin accumulation in the three direction. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's this. I agree that it's a bit difficult to define it mathematically, because this is this the intention is for one dimension is I think perfectly clear. Yeah, but the point I want to make is the following, and this is important, because I will be dealing with the interaction between a system like that and a pumped system and a non-pumped system. So the question is, what parameter is now producing, let's say, the spin currents? Is it the magnetization, or is it this guy? And my point is, it's not the magnetization. Yes? Yeah? So this would be, let's say, a situation where you have an equilibrium magnetization. That is not relevant for spin transport. You could say what is relevant is this part. You could also call it the non-equilibrium part of the magnetization. Yeah?
This is, again, trying to pinpoint the definition. This is the electrochemical potential difference between spin up and spin down.
Yeah.
What you want to do, that part is fine. You somehow now want to generate a vector out of that.
Yeah.
And so what you're saying in three dimensions, I can think of that, since spin has three vectorial components,
yeah,
that there will be three different quantities in general,
yeah,
for spin up and down in three different directions. This is what you're saying.
Yes.
And electrochemical potential difference drives current, so this is what drives current. So that's fine.
And I would say that what this thing is, it's the electron density matrix, coarse grain.
Let me proceed. We will continue our fight later. So I was here, but the point is, so what you now can understand that if you have a magnetic field which is then processing, yeah, that you will have also a spin accumulation. So this is the thing which you would measure in transport, which has an oscillating component, yeah, because it clearly has to follow the magnetic field in some way. But what is relevant now is measuring AC components is very difficult, certainly if you have already big oscillating magnetic fields. You can never distinguish, it will be very difficult to distinguish AC voltages which are somehow result from AC spin currents, if you already have big AC magnetic fields on to generate them. But what of course you can see is a possible DC component, yeah, like in the previous experiment. So the point is now the following, that due to this process, I mean due to the, let's say, the inertia, there will be a component of this spin accumulation which will be perpendicular to B, and which will thus, and this will be, could be perpendicular here, and if B is rotated further on, it will again be perpendicular. So that means it has the tendency to process around B and produce a non-equilibrium spin accumulation in the Z direction. And this will be a constant, yeah, because due to this, the rotational invariant. Yeah? So this is a way to understand, simple way to understand, that if you have a system like this, paramagnetic system, you can also measure, you can also generate this is a processing magnetic field, but as I will show you, it can also be done by an oscillating magnetic field. You can produce a DC component of the spin accumulation, which you in principle could measure electrically. Let me proceed. So, what I do now is the following. I've shown you this Bloch equation. I've shown you this component. This is the relaxation term. This is the precession term. This is the, of course, the sum of all these currents is equal to the mu dt. Of course, everything is normalized. Everything, there should be always here the, of course, the precession or the relaxation current, of course, scales with the density of states. If you make it the density of states twice as big at the Fermi energy, of course, this current will become twice as big. But on the other hand, the mu dt, this spin up is relaxing to spin down, has to fill the spin down states. But if the density of states increases with a factor of 2 there, this form will also change. So you can just drops out density of states. But what was now relevant is this is we already seen. But this was the introduction of this term. So if you want to do the full mathematical description, we have to solve this equation and we have to put in for this source term, the one which I already discussed. It's a source term which is given by g mu b times dB dt.
So the question of whether the term b cross mu or not is something that we can discuss later.
I'd be fully happy to do that, but let me.
But there's no, yeah.
Let me.
Go on.
Let me. I mean, I can assure you that we have thought about this. So. So let me proceed. So what do we do? So first we want to imitate, let's say, or how is the, maybe that's the right word? We would like to see whether. Okay, let's now make a model of our paramagnetic region, where we have a magnetic field which produces, of course, now a time-dependent Zeeman energy, which of course in general will be much smaller than the exchange energy, but it will basically be the same mechanism which acts on the electrons as you would have in a ferromagnet. It's much smaller, the effect is much smaller. Here we can use a bulk description. In a conventional ferromagnet we cannot do that, but let's see how far we can get here. So we are now making a constant field in the Z direction, and we are making an oscillating a precessing field in the, or rotating field in the XY direction, so that indeed the total field makes some kind of precession motion. So, well, now it's just a matter of rather straightforward mathematics. There is nothing mysterious here. So what is relevant is we can calculate now the component of the spin accumulation parallel to B. So B goes like this, and we can also, and of course this is in a rotating frame. We can calculate the component parallel. You could call it the dispersive component. This is the component perpendicular, which is the absorptive component, and this is the one we are actually interested in. This is the constant DC component in the Z direction. Yeah? So, what does it mean now? We already get, in the bulk, without an interface, we already get that a magnetic field like this produces a spin accumulation. It is proportional to H bar omega, which is the fundamental thing, but it has also a prefactor. And the prefactor is determined by this guy. This is the omega z, is the Larmor, you could say the resonance frequency corresponding with the big constant magnetic field. Omega is the actual frequency with which you drive the AC field. So you could see this is indeed a resonance. When you're driving, like in electron spin resonance, it's a similar thing. When you drive your system in such a way that your applied frequency corresponds with the resonant frequency, well, this drops out. But you see then you're still left with the term omega xy tau, and tau is the ferromagnetic relaxation time, and omega xy corresponds to the Larmor precession frequency of, let's say, the in general, of course, small field in the xy plane. So if you apply this to metals, what do you find? That this guy in general will be much smaller than 1. Yeah, because this one will be in experiments, few millitesla, which you can do, times this one, the field is few millitesla, so this would be like 0.1 or 0.01. So you see that in the bulk, and this is important to remember, if you put in realistic parameters, you're able to achieve, but you already have to apply AC fields of millitesla, you are able to achieve spin accumulations which are a certain percentage of H-bar. Again, I can say tell about that, but let's.
There is a difference.
So there's two differences. This does not correspond with the regular electron spin resonance theory. It corresponds with the, how would you say, not with the regular equations, but with the there is something like the extended equations, and this has all to do with the fact I have a big magnetic field, and I have, so that means that and a small AC field in the X and the Y direction, and then one of the questions is, this is all phenomenological, I have to say, for this electron spin resonance theory, you have to assume if you have a certain magnetization angle, it will relax with a typical relaxation time, but you have to put in, it will relax to what? Yeah? Will it relax to the direction which is in the Z direction, or will it relax to the direction which is the instantaneous direction of the magnetic field? Yeah? So that's, well, again, it's a bit technical. The other thing is that we focus on the spin accumulation. This describes magnetization, which I've told you is a different.
From what points you also get density measures, which describes
it? I'll be happy to go into detail maybe a bit later. I mean, it's a good question, but let me first show you the line of my
argumentation.
So, if you want to do this, is it very useful? You would say maybe not. Yeah, but so even in resonance, when omega is omega z, you need to get, let's say, the universal result h bar omega. You have to have satisfy the condition omega x y tau much bigger than one, and that's not easily done. Yeah, so in general, if you will do it, you get spin accumulations which are much smaller than h bar omega. Now comes, of course, the big surprise. What I'm now going to do is I'm going to simulate more or less the situation where this would be a ferromagnet, which is precessing, and this would be a non-ferromagnetic region. This was actually how we started to think about it. So how would we do it? Again, we have this Bloch equation. This again is the source term, and now we have to introduce the diffusion term, because we have now a non-homogeneous region. We should allow for the diffusion of spins back and forth between, let's say, the pumped region, where I have a magnetic field which I described, and a magnetic field which makes this nice precession cone, and the region where there's no pumping, there's no magnetic field also. Yeah. So now, if we do that, what we get is a rather surprising result. Because for this is the system where we have an infinite pumped region, and we have a infinite non-pumped region. And what I'm plotting now is the magnitude of the spin accumulation in the z direction. And I'm plotting this as for this parameter. So this is a frequency of 10 gigahertz. Well, this is a reasonable frequency which you use for resonance. But I have to say also, this is the situation where bz is zero. So there's only a magnetic field which rotates in the xy plane. And now this is really funny, in my opinion. So I plot now as a function of the position, but it's normalized by the spin relaxation length. I have put in, also, it's a simplification, that the spin relaxation length in the pumped region is the same as in the non-pumped region, which makes sense, of course, if it's the same material. If it would be a ferromagnet, it would not make sense. But we assume that this is the same piece of paramagnetic metal. We have one region here where we apply this magnetic field, and we have one region where there's no field at all. So what you see, so if you have a spin relaxation time which is small, I mean 10 minus 10, it would be 100 picoseconds. This is a typical value for metals. You see now that if you go to the interface, well, this is more or less what you expect. Because here, if you sit at the interface, you generate spins, but they can leak out into the normal region and relax. So this is typical behavior which you would expect. So here you have just the bulk effect, here is the interface, but these spins which go from across my interface will just leak out and relax. So it will reduce your effect. However, if I now increase the spin relaxation time in steps of factor of 10, what you see is the following. That in the bulk, you see that finally the effect saturates. It does not go to its universal value. However, if you go to the interface, you see that there is a huge enhancement. You go up here, and then finally you start to approach. This is one mu z equal to h bar omega zero, universal value. So this is, of course, very strange. So this shows that I have a region where I do this spin pumping, and I add an interface, and I let spins go into the non-pumped region, and actually this creates an enhancement. Yeah?
I'm slightly confused. It's not theory, right, so far?
Yes. That's no reason to be confused.
Okay, no. Make sure they are not
studying
it. No, this is an old fact. About 15 years ago, but on all the theories, I did an experiment this of the week, and you also get the theory called.
That's okay.
This is the idea.
This is the same thing, but now we have actually make a model which we call weak ferromagnet model. We have to be careful here, because let's say even a weak ferromagnet would give an exchange interaction which would not be 100 tesla but even 1000 tesla. This is a situation where we have a small precession cone. Now it becomes even more dramatic, because look at this. At low relaxation, this is the bulk effect, and you can believe me that this all saturates if you go far away into the ferromagnet to this value of 10 minus 4. If you go now to the interface, this enhancement becomes even bigger. Yeah? So what's this now?
Lambda
is the spin relaxation length. It's this. Is the following. We have a diffusion. This is the we have put in the time. Here we put
different power.
It depends on.
Larger. Lengths are very different that you're talking about.
Yes, the length.
The length of orders of magnitude different.
The length you should take into account that also if I change tall, I agree with you that also lambda changes.
Right.
But this is the normalized.
In this figure, say, yeah. 18 orders of magnitude. So it's from a few angstroms to several kilometers.
Well, maybe not, but of course you see that already. I need not realistic. Spin relaxation times.
I mean,
this figure is very strange. So what we have assumed only, there is only a bulk spin pumping effect. We see that by the addition of the interface, we get a behavior like this. But now look at it. It looks almost, if you go into the normal region, this is of course what you expect. This is a logarithmic scale. You see that the signal decays exponentially with lambda. This is just what you expect. I have a source of spin current here. If I go into the non-magnetic region, the spin accumulation drops exponentially. You see that it's the same for all of these curves. But you see also that if you go back into the ferromagnet, you more or less see the same behavior. So it looks like at the interface, you are effectively injecting a spin current. Yeah? Which can then diffuse in this direction and diffuse in this direction. But we have not put in that in explicitly. We have only included this by this, what you call source term, which is, let's say, uniform. And we have not put in the behavior of the interface explicitly. So, given the time, and I really want to show this this paramagnetic maser idea, I am going a bit faster here. So what is the reason for this? This is L omega. You should of course take into account that if electrons go into the normal region, they will relax due to spin relaxation. So they will draw out spin current. But of course that is, can only reduce the spin accumulation. But what happens here of course, that you have your magnetization or your spin accumulation in the ferromagnet or in the pumped region which is precessing. Well, but if these electrons are at a certain time, electrons are with a certain spin are emitted into the non-magnetic region, they're not going to process again. They're not going to process. So whereas the spin accumulation in the pumped region is continuing to process. What it means that these electrons with their spin in a certain direction, they will come back a little bit later. But in the meantime, let's say the spin direction the spin accumulation in the ferromagnet has already proceeded. So they will come back now, but if you take into account this region, these spins look like, their spins are completely randomized. Huh? So you see that this L omega can have two different meanings. The omega can be the omega, as I showed you with the static experiment, is induced by a precession of a by a magnetic field. But the omega can also mean that I have a region where the spin accumulation is already processing with a frequency omega. And if it now can leak out into a region where there is no precession, and they come back, this you have a similar length scale. So this would mean that components, the x and the y components of the spin, you can understand this, but I will not go into detail here, by not only taking into account the spin relaxation, but by taking into account the averaging of the x and the y component. You can put in a simple model. It's all in the paper which I refer to, and that seems to make sense. I can also compare it with the Bauer-Brata-Tsarkovnikov spin pumping theory. Let me go on here. This I will not show. This is basically the point I was making. So the crucial thing is the following. So realize this: if I have a region where I have a magnetic field, which is then spin pumping, I connect it to a region where there is no magnetic field, I have to take into account the averaging of the x and the y components of the spin, which can dramatically change my effect. Okay, so I think this is a nice one. This is, I think, really easy to understand. Again, this is still theory at the moment. So what was I doing now? I was basically inputting in with the spin pumping experiments RF power from my magnetic field on a medium. So this medium will respond by creating a non-equilibrium spin accumulation, which has a constant value in the z direction and oscillating components in the x and the y. So there will be spin relaxation. So since it's a non-equilibrium situation, spins will flip, and there will be dissipation. By the way, this dissipation is very much of the Landauer shape, so or a Landauer form. It's very much the same as you would make a point contact. You could also say, wait a minute, if an electron goes through a point contact, it enters a new region. But even if it would go there with conservation of energy, you know that finally it has to give off its energy, so there will be dissipation. So this is more or less the same thing, but if somebody is interested in that. But the point is, I apply RF power. Well, this medium absorbs some of this power to create dissipation. I can also get some power out because I had this constant spin accumulation in the z-direction. So if I now connect this to two contacts, one which has magnetization up, the other one which has a magnetization down, and if they are all 100% polarized, I can make a voltage. I can take some electrical power out of that. So that means that, of course, in the general situation, you have net absorption of RF power. So if you can say I have this big thing coming in, what finally comes out is attenuated. Yeah? So this is the regular situation. But now the question is, could I also reverse this? Suppose now I'm able to inject power from a spin injection source, which would mean, suppose now I inject spins into this paramagnetic medium. So let's say if I would inject a spin current with, let's say, if I would inject, let's say, spin up in the z-direction or spin down, I will do this and by some means. Would it be possible that I create this situation and I still apply some RF magnetic field, that I get more power out than I put in? This would, of course, be a maser, because we're talking about RF frequencies. So somehow we have a medium which we pump in such a way that we get more RF power out than we put in. Is that possible? No, the answer is yes. So how do we do this? I mean, this is the geometry. This is, I think, simpler than that you cannot think of. So what we do is the following. We have a ferromagnet here. We need this ferromagnet because we are going to make a tunnel junction. This would be a aluminum, let's say, a metal or some other paramagnetic material. Could be a semiconductor. This is an oxide. Yeah? Well, again, if you use an oxide or not, does not really matter, because the idea is that we connect this circuit to a current source, or a voltage source, doesn't matter. So we send current through this tunnel barrier. And it's exactly the same as what I showed in the first experiment. The idea is that we inject a spin current into this paramagnetic region, which is then in the same direction as the magnetization of my ferromagnet. What I do is I also apply a relatively large magnetic field in the z-direction. Well, that I do for two purposes. One of them is to align the magnetization of my ferromagnet in the z-direction. Well, you can also think about different geometries, but this is the simplest one. I can do it. So if I take a piece of permalloy and I apply one Tesla, well, the magnetization will be aligned perpendicular. So it's important to realize that the only reason for this ferromagnet is that it gives a source of spin-polarized electrons in the z-direction into my paramagnetic region. The dynamics of the ferromagnet is not relevant for this experiment. What else do I have? I have a BX and a BY. So how can such a magnetic field be created? Well, you could say, wait a minute, I'm injecting spins in the positive z-direction. So these spins are going to create a small magnetic field in the z-direction. There would be no reason why there would be a magnetic field in the x and the y-direction. Yeah, this is we have a steady state. Here we just send a constant current through. We are injecting a constant spin accumulation, spin current. What this current will do, it will relax after some time. So we will generate also a constant spin accumulation in the z direction. That's all. That would be a first order guess. So this is not an interesting situation. However, this is wrong. This is wrong because, of course, we have a system which is, well, you could say, translationally invariant in time. But that doesn't mean that the possible solutions for the spin accumulation here have to be constant in time. We can allow for solutions which go like exponent I omega t. And well, we have to actually see if they are there. So you could even say we have to do some kind of stability analysis. We have to see that if we would apply maybe a small oscillating component in the x and the y direction, well, these spins will respond to that, and maybe they are going to also create they are going to create a magnetic field of themselves. And if we feed that back, we might still have be able to have a solution which oscillates as a function of time. Well, this is all very complicated in words. In an equation, it's very simple. It's this equation. Yeah? So what we have done, we already had this. So this is again the spin pumping term due to the total magnetic field. And now we add this one. This is a very simple one. This is just represents the spin current which is injected in the z direction. And we take that one constant. So we had this equation. And we just add this one. That's all. And we solve it. If we do that, I think for us it was quite a funny surprise. Well, this is all done. You can do it on an envelope, back of an envelope. That is not the point. You see now that we see that what happens is that the component parallel to M is changed, because it used to be H bar omega. Now we get, as an additional term, we get mu s. What is mu s? Mu s is the spin accumulation which would be induced in the normal metal in the absence of any AC fields. It's just a regular, it's just the balance between the spin current which is pumped in and the spin relaxation. So the mu parallel is changed by that one. The mu perpendicular is changed by, it's in the same way. And for the spin accumulation in the z direction, it's changed in a little bit different one. And of course, it has to be so, because suppose now there is no AC magnetic field, so omega xy is zero, then mu z, of course, should be equal to mu s. But what does this mean? And the best thing I can do is to show this on the next one. If I would now represent all of these guys, so I'm now, this would be the direction of my magnetic field. Of course, I'm now, it's of course a steady state where the whole thing is rotating with the frequency omega, but I just fixed the direction. Eh? So now this is my magnetic field. The component mu parallel would of course be pointing in this direction, and of course the component mu perpendicular in this direction, and of course mu z in this direction. Let's go back. But this would be the regular situation where, let's say, the mu parallel would lag the spin accumulation would lag behind with respect to the direction of the magnetic field. But if you go back to this equation, so this would be correspond to the situation where mu s is zero. Now, if I make mu s equal to minus h bar omega, you see that this term disappears. So there is no mu parallel anymore. If I go proceed and I make mu s smaller than minus h bar omega, I can go from a situation like this through a situation like this through a situation like that. So it's no longer lagging behind, but it's leading. Yeah? So if this corresponds to absorption, then this situation must correspond to emission. So this corresponds to a situation where actually the spin system is now not absorbing power from the magnetic field, but it's giving back, or it's adding to the magnetic field. So it's a gain. We have a medium which has gain. That's all. It's as simple as this. So how do we go further? Of course, this is a bit discrete. We would never do it like this. But so what we're now going to do is we are going to make need 5 more minutes. What we're going to do is we're going to put our medium, which has the spins here. We're going to put this like in the old days with masers. We're going to put it in some coil. We have some resonant circuit, which is also a C0. And of course, we have some damping in this external circuit. So what we could do, and this would be experiment number one, we have some AC source. And we tune the frequency of this AC source so that the resonance frequency, so that it's tuned to the resonance frequency of this circuit, which of course depends on C0 and L. But of course the amplitude of the resonance is determined by the loss, is determined by R0, or the quality factor. But now you see that since we have now our spins in a coil, which would have a effective inductance L, you can actually show that this the total inductance is now the, well, the you could say the bare inductance with nothing inside, but it's modified by something like 1 plus Q times chi, and Q is the filling factor, which actually says how much of the volume is actually filled with this medium, and chi is the magnetic susceptibility of our medium. So this magnetic susceptibility, of course, has two components. It has one which corresponds with the you could say dispersive component, and the other one which is the x double prime. It's the absorption. And now you see that you can change the x double prime if you put in the numbers. You can change this from absorption, dissipative, if mu s is zero, to you can change the sign of this guy. Yeah? If mu s becomes smaller than minus h bar omega. No, that's more or less what you do. So now you can translate back, which is also not a complicated matter, this into again a discrete circuit, where you have again the capacitor is not changed. Now actually the coil or the inductance consists now of the bare inductance. It consists of a component here, which is basically due to the response of your spin system in the direction of the field. But here R prime, this is now a negative resistance, which describes the gain from this circuit. So, conclusion is that if I satisfy this condition, that if I inject a spin accumulation bigger than h bar omega, this R prime will become negative. But of course, you see there is still R0, which is positive. It's the intrinsic loss of the circuit. However, so what happens now if R prime becomes bigger than R0? Then the total resistance in my circuit becomes negative. And that means that it starts to oscillate by itself. It does not no longer need this external... it does no longer need the external driving force. It will start to make up its own oscillation. And of course, at some point, it will saturate at some value. What is the condition for all of this nice thing? And of course, you can also translate this in the following. You can define a quality factor of your external circuit, which is given by omega, the frequency, times L0, which is, let's say, the bare inductance of your coil, over R0. And R0 is, let's say, the dissipation, or the, let's say, the typical dissipative resistance in your circuit. This guy has to be bigger than this factor. Yeah, you see that what this factor includes is of course the mu s. I mean, if you make mu s bigger, then of course you can create more. It's more favorable for this Mayer action. But you see, it also contains tau, the spin relaxation time. The bigger tau is, of course, the bigger you expect the spin accumulations to be. So also the bigger you expect the magnetic field to be. If you put in numbers, you find, this is what we really did, you put for aluminum, you put that in. And what you have to put in, so you find the quality factor of your circuit should be bigger than 1 over the spin accumulation measured in electron volt. So what does that now mean? And this is about 200, because you can make an estimate what is the maximum spin accumulation you would be able to achieve in some piece of metal. And it's a couple of milli electron volts. You have to, this is really approximately the maximum. And if you put that in, a few milli electron volts, then it means the quality factor has to be bigger than 200. That is a relatively big quality factor. I mean, and it's not trivial to realize this at these type of frequencies. You could even imagine if you take a superconductor, you can get a much higher quality factor. So, well, this is the prediction. Yeah. So the prediction is very simple. I think there are not so many predictions which are simpler than this. Let me go to the original situation. If you make a structure like this, and you create a sufficiently large spin accumulation, it can actually even be made of aluminum, which still has a relatively small spin relaxation time. You couple it to an external circuit in an efficient way, which will, of course, probably not be having a coil around it. You have to define your resonant circuit. You do that. You apply a sufficiently large spin accumulation. You inject a sufficiently spin current. Then the prediction is that this thing will start to oscillate by itself. And it derives, of course, the power is, of course, supplied by the source. I have to say that this is, if you put in the realistic parameters for metallic system, it's very inefficient. because all of this, of course, is determined by the spin current. There is, of course, in the meantime, also a relatively big charge current through your system. It's also generating some ohmic losses. And so we made an estimate that in this geometry, the efficiency would be 10 minus 5. But if you are interested in a proof of principle of this kind of thing, I think it doesn't matter at this point what is the efficiency.
How are you going to couple the power out?
You have to measure it. Sorry?
How do you couple power out of the system if you get some resonance?
Oh, okay. Let me show. I should say, of course, that within this, with this such a coil construction, of course, you only apply an AC field along the, let's say, X direction. You can actually show that this is already sufficient, because you can always decompose an oscillating field in terms of a, or a processing field in terms of an oscillating field in the X direction.